Let's start with your main point, which is countering violent extremism, the fight against Daesh, what we sometimes call ISIL, and your emotional evocation of the Berlin Airlift. Do you think we need to be doing more now in Syria to try to change, get the change we need in Syria in order to defeat Daesh there?
Well, the President knows we need to do more, and we're working on precisely what that more is in a number of different ways. He has upped the number of special forces, American soldiers, who are on the ground as enablers, not in direct combat, but enabling this forward progression to take place. And much of the progress we've made that I just articulated has come from these terrific efforts of that coordination. In addition, we're working with our allies more closely to figure out what they can plus up in order to do this. But the most important thing, frankly, is seeing if we can reach an understanding with the Russians about how to, number one, deal with Daesh and al-Nusra. Al-Nusra is the other group there. Jabhat al-Nusra, our designated terrorist group by the United Nations. And there are a couple of subgroups underneath the two designated, Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, Jaish al-Islam, Ahrar al-Sham particularly, who brush off and fight with that, alongside these other two sometimes, to fight the Assad regime. So we need to create a level of trust and stability about the country as a whole so that the idea of a transition government and something moving away from Assad is not frightening to people, because legitimately to some people it is today.
And is Lavrov helping you get the Russians to move?
Well, the Russians, you know, it's a mixed bag, and we have to get clarity, and that's what we're working on. We've got, we're in the middle of discussions right now. I'm not going to go into them in any depth, but I think it is possible to try to create a new paradigm here, and that could really change the game if we're able to.
And what would a new paradigm be?
Well, where we have an understanding about how we move in Geneva at the political table, even as we have an understanding of how we can work more effectively together to be able to get rid of the terrorists.
And does that mean getting rid of Assad?
Well, I personally believe that you can never unify the country and you can never have real peace if Assad is still there, because Assad is, you know, the magnet for much of this jihadism that takes place. It has other overtones, and there, you know, this is what makes this such an extraordinarily complicated challenge, because you have, we have 21 or so entities at the table of the International Syria Support Group. Now among them, Iran and Russia. Well, they have a different take on Assad, but they're at the table to try to help move the process. But we also have Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, who have different take on what their tolerance level is for certain groups. And then you have Kurds, who are clearly fighting for their own defined territory with Turkey, and you have Kurds on Kurds. And so in addition to that, you have the overhang of Shia-Sunni, which until recent memory was not as sharp a line drawn in the region, but it has become that. And then further complicating things, you have Arab-Persian and Iran. So you've got an overlay of as many different bases of interest, and therefore the settlement becomes much harder.
Now that Iran is at that table with you, obviously they want to protect Assad a little bit, but they also are very fervent in getting rid of Daesh, like we are. Are they being more helpful or more harmful?
Well, I know this will fall. I mean, look, we have challenges with Iran, as everybody knows, and we're working on those challenges. But I can tell you that Iran in Iraq has been, in certain ways, helpful, and they clearly are focused on ISIL, Daesh, and so we have a common interest, actually.
And do you think the Iran deal helped get us to have more common interests?
There's no question that it opened up the opportunity for communication. I mean, You know, when our sailors stumbled into Iranian territory and got held, 2 years ago, we wouldn't have known who we would have called the Swiss. Mm-hmm. We would have called some other country and said, can you help us? And enough time would have gone by, and there would have been sufficient level of enmity that those guys would have probably been hostages, and we'd have had another situation. But within 30 minutes, I had my counterpart on the phone. Within an hour and a half, we had a deal. It was clear they were going to come out, and we were going to, you know, not make this a bad moment in what we were trying to achieve. So that's a benefit that came out of the whole process. And even now, we are working on other things. And look, Jason Mazayan is sitting here.
Jason's a wonderful Washington Post reporter who was held, and I think Secretary helped get him out. Jason, thank you for being with us.
But this is a, you know, this is a tough one. But I think we're going to make some progress in the next.
And can you envision 5 to 10 years from now Iran being more of a partner than an adversary?
I don't want to make any guesses. That's too fraught with too many variables. It really is, Walter. I mean,
Sure. Look,
the hope is everybody understands that Iran is going through certain change. President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif. I have a vision that was carried out in the context of sitting down with us and negotiating. There were those in Iran who didn't want to do that.
And should business leaders here trade and open up relations with Iran more now?
Well, it's up to them. If they have business that they do, it's open to that.
Would that help our foreign policy?
Well, certain businesses are open to that. It's not generically open to every business yet. We still have sanctions in place from our what we call our primary sanctions that were put in place because of state support for terror or human rights abuse or missile shoots or arms embargo.
And now are we better off in those fields now?
We're better off in the last few months.
Okay.
There was some, we had to sanction, we sanctioned additionally a few months ago because of a missile shoot. We're prepared to do that again if we have to. Our hope is that we can continue to open the aperture. And there are those in Iran. You know, we had people bitterly opposed to the deal here in America. They had people bitterly opposed to the deal in Iran. It was a very tough fight there, just as it was a tough fight here. But that's the nature of change. I mean, you have to, you know, fight for something that's rational.
You were just in Rome where you helped, I say, bless the deal between Netanyahu and the Turks, which has got to be very helpful. I know you probably have somewhere, either in your head or in your office, maps of what could be the map that we could have helped solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Is there a possibility of movement while you're still in office? Would you lay down a plan, perhaps, or suggest something?
Well, let me answer that this way. I had a very constructive meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. We've probably spent more time together as Prime Minister and as Secretary of State than any duo in history, I think. And I think we know what we're trying to do. It's very tricky. I am always the optimist. I'm always hopeful that we could try to get something moving if possible. One thing I know is this. The status quo is unsustainable. You cannot continue moving in a way that is increasingly making a two-state solution impossible. And as the settlements expand, and as you have increasing violence and back and forth and tit for tat, blame here, blame there, the people harden, and it gets more difficult. But the notion that you can have a Jewish state and a democracy and have a unitary state, given the fact that already today the population between the Jordan River and the sea is majority non-Jewish. So it's critical for Israel, for its future, to find a way to get into a real negotiation. And it's not all Israel. The Palestinians need to make moves and be open to things and not just shut doors. And
do you have any plans to go over there?
Well, I'm in the region frequently for various reasons, but right now we're working with Israel, particularly on the Daesh issue and the ISIL issue. Daesh is in the Sinai, Daesh is in the Golan, and you can see them from the Golan in nearby areas. That's a threat to Israel. It's a threat to us, a threat to the region.
Do they have a joint security? Do they share something with the Palestinians and that both want Daesh out of the Golan?
For sure. Daesh is no friend of the Palestinians. Abu Mazen is a committed, he wants two states, he wants nonviolent approach to it. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't always get that. And there is incitement in the West Bank that has to stop. And we've tried to hold people accountable for that incitement. And we are continually working with both sides to try to massage this process forward. But you have to have two willing parties. We can't want this more than they do.
You just said in your talk that globalism, there's been a reaction to it that's involved nativism, nationalism, tribalism. Do you think that undercurrent explains what's happening in, some instance, Austria, Hungary, France, Germany, and the Brexit vote, and the United States?
I think it explains a great, great deal of it. You know, I had a professor at Yale who taught me John Morton Blum, great historian. And I've never forgotten a phrase in one of the lectures in which I was actually awake. My fault, not his, believe me. He said, all politics is a reaction to felt needs. And I thought about that, you know, and the more I practice, the more it's absolutely true. It's just felt needs. So it doesn't have to be a real need. It doesn't have to be, you know, fully developed or perceived. But if it's felt, it's real, and you got to deal with it. And what's happening today is, you know, I supported trade. Why did I support trade? Well, because 95% of the world's customers live in other countries. If we're going to grow, we got to be able to sell to other people, and they've got to sell to us. And so it made sense to me, providing it's fair, providing it's done in a way where you're not being taken advantage of, people can share the benefits, and so forth. In the 1990s, during the great tech boom of the 90s, every quintile of American income earners saw their income go up.
Yeah.
Everybody. And we did better. And it was a $1 trillion market with about 1 billion users. And of course, it was the tech market, the personal computer and communications. The market we're looking at today to get out from under the cloud of climate change is energy market. It's already a 4 to 5 billion user market compared to one. It's already a multi-trillion dollar market compared to one, and it will go up to 9 billion users in the next 20 to 40 years. This is the mother of all markets. And if we accelerate our efforts to convert rapidly to alternative, renewable, and different infrastructure and create grids, I mean, we don't even have a grid in America, folks. We have a great big gap in the center of our country. You can't sell energy from Texas to Massachusetts or Minnesota or other places. It's nuts. We're supposed to be the leading developed country of the world. But actually, other countries have better infrastructure in certain areas than we do today. Walk through many of their airports, and you know what I'm talking about. Try and get a cart in some of our airports where you need it before you get out of the airport when you don't need it. It's insanity. You know, it's so, you know, we've got to get cooking, that's all.
On climate change, do you think that Brexit might make it a little bit harder now with England out?
It depends entirely on what arrangement is made. This is a very complicated divorce because the Brits do not want to announce the what's called Article 50 announcement that they're leaving, because then the two-year timetable begins to trigger. And they're afraid that they could sit there for 2 years, be negotiating, and at the end of the negotiation, there isn't a deal, and they're stuck. Now, they're told by our friends in Europe, you don't have to worry. We want you to do as well as possible. We need you. And they do. And I think it's true. But there's no element of trust sufficient there for them to start the process. If they don't start the process, then there's uncertainty in the marketplace and uncertainty in Europe, and a whole lot of people get angrier and angrier. And then you have the potential of people taking out, you know, saying, well, we're not going to give them that because they didn't help us at all when we needed it. Mm-hmm. And you get into this tit for tat. So the whole thing, you know, really depends on the wisdom and calmness and vision with which people come to the table to try to cut the deal by which they will, quote, be out, but there'll be a market and they'll have rules that work for everybody, or they don't decide to get out, I don't know what's going to happen.
Wait, follow up on that. How could they not decide to get out? Because Christine Lagarde mentions that, a lot of people mentioned it here.
There's a lot of talk in England today of having another vote. And Cameron said it won't happen, certainly not for about a year or so, whatever, but a year fits within a two-year period.
Yeah, yeah.
So who knows? I can't sit here and tell you that I know what is going
to
happen.
So Prime Minister Cameron yesterday, when you talked to him at Downing Street, I guess, indicated he won't invoke Article 50, right?
He believes that he won't because he feels powerless, and I think this is a fair conclusion, to go out and start negotiating something that he doesn't believe in, and that he has no idea how he would do it. And by the way, nor do most of the people who voted to do it.
So what other ways are there for them to walk this cat back, since the sovereignty is still in Parliament?
I think there are a number of ways. I don't, as Secretary of State, want to throw them out today. I think that'd be a mistake.
Okay.
But there are a number of ways.
Good. You were talking too about whether there might be some fallout of Brexit when you go to Warsaw with the NATO ministers. Do you think Brexit and the threat of Brexit, since we don't know if it's going to happen, will strengthen NATO or might weaken it?
No, I think it will strengthen NATO. Mm-hmm. David Cameron and Britain have met their 2% of GDP allocation to NATO. They will stick with that. They have declared that they intend to be front and center and fully participatory. We have four framework countries that are going to be taking on a reassurance training program for frontline states. And we, the United States, will be doing it in Poland, and the Brits and Canada and one other country, I forget which, are going to be doing...
Germany,
thank you very much.
The ambassador from Germany, Peter Wittig, speaks up. He actually knew the answer, but he wanted you to help him.
Vielen Dank, Deutschland. We are very grateful. And Germany is going to, which is very, very important, and the four of us are going to be trained. So NATO is going to be stronger. I don't have any question about it. NATO is taking on a stronger southern mission, a stronger mission dealing with migration out of Greece. It may even take on additional mission with respect to Libya. We'll have to wait and see. But I'm very confident that NATO is going to be strengthened coming out of this, and I think everybody will bend over backwards in Warsaw to make sure that's clear.
Let me open it up, because I know I've, Jeff Goldberg. Yeah.
Thank you, Walter. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I want to stay on something that Walter was talking to you about, the Iran deal and the consequence of the Iran deal. Two interesting developments the past couple of weeks. The first is that your department has relisted Iran once again as the world's primary state sponsor of terrorism. The second is that your administration is considering approving the sale of approximately $25 billion worth of Boeing aircraft to Iran. Now, two observations out of that. The first is that we know that in the past, Iran has used civilian aircraft to resupply Hezbollah, to resupply the Assad regime. We also know that within the administration, you are one of the most fervent advocates for more action against the Assad regime, including military action against the Assad regime. So I'm just trying to understand this, and I'm not understanding the thought process that goes into the possible approval of the Boeing deal, given what you think about Iran's role in terrorism and what you think about Iran's role in Syria?
Well, it's a very good and very fair question, and I don't think there's a fault line in our approach or in my thinking about it or the president's thinking about it. About 60% of the people in Iran are under the age of 30. People who have been to Tehran tell me of a Tehran in which young people are sitting in cafes talking about the future, educated in other countries, looking to a very different place. And the revolutionary streak part of Iran, which is what it brought us the terror, and the principal reasons for the designation go back to Khobar Towers and Hezbollah. And it continues with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a terrorist-designated organization by the United States of America, which is building up a weapons arsenal, a missile arsenal that's aimed at Tel Aviv and other parts of Israel. It's a risk and a danger. And it's not their country, it's not their people. These are a terrorist organization in another country that's being supported by Iran. So you're absolutely, we're gonna call them on it. We're gonna absolutely stay focused on that. But at the same time, we're trying to move the process thoughtfully, and doing business is one of the best ways to create interests and a vested purpose, if you will, in furthering transformation. And so I think, and by the way, tell me what makes sense. In the United States of America, negotiating a deal with Iran to allow people to lift the sanctions, which we did, but other countries like France are rushing in to sell Airbus to the cost of Washington State and Boeing and our workers in the United States. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think we ought to sell what other people can sell, but not break completely with our primary sanctions, which continue to put pressure on to move them to recognize that there's still unfinished business and there's certain things we will not tolerate. Now, it's complex, folks. Issues in foreign policy don't always, if they lend themselves to, just right and wrong, black and white, simple line, you draw it, you're often wrong. And I fought in a war that was drawn that way. And we know how wrong that was. So I'm for looking at the subtleties and understanding all of the rationale for what is happening in a country. We were not good for a long period of time at looking at other countries through their lens, not just ours. And if all we do is interpret problems in other countries as Americans in our lens, through our felt need, we are neglecting the felt need of all the other people who will also make up policy decisions that have an impact on us. So the distinction between the planes and the other things is, I think, trying to draw a line that threads a needle. It's a very difficult needle to thread, but very important in order to have a transformation that doesn't send you down the road to a needless confrontation or to misunderstanding or to lost opportunity.
Thank you. I'm having trouble with all the lights, but I see where the microphone is. Okay, John Dickerson and Richard and Jane. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be fair here.
Mr. Secretary, on this question of tribalism, you talk about the felt need. What's the 5-point plan for the felt need in states, in Europe, in England? And as a part of that, when the president said that Great Britain was going to have to go to the back of the queue, did he misunderstand the felt need? And how can nothing have changed if he said that they're now going to the back of the queue?
Well, I think the president very clearly was talking about TTIP and the fact that we have 27 countries we have to negotiate with, or now potentially 27 countries, that we have to negotiate with to get that done. And if you have a whole bunch of countries working to get one thing done, and that's the larger market, it makes sense to try to get it done. So, but I think given what has happened, the president is going to try and do both at the same time. He knows how to multitask. So if we have to, put more effort into helping, but for the moment, it's up to the Europeans and the British really to manage how they're going to do this. We don't want to meddle. We're not trying to insert ourselves into the middle of it. It would be inappropriate. We have interests. We will clearly talk with them about it. But they've got to come to some understanding of how they're going to meet the felt needs of both their people. Now, you say, what's the felt need? I mean, obviously, in Great Britain, there was a huge amount of this vote that was caught up in the migration issue. Huge amount. Mm-hmm. There also was a huge amount caught up in the large parts of England, and you just look at the map and see where the votes were, that feel left out from all the gains of the great financial center of London and all of the growth that's taking place in Ireland or in other parts of the country. So that's, all politics has always been driven by that. Jobs, and you better be able to employ people because you're not going to have much revenue to, do the other things you want to do if you don't have a pretty healthy economy. So I think that's the felt need that's predominant, frankly, and that drove this vote to a very large measure. Now, tribalism is not new, folks. I'm amazed, when I went to college, I don't remember a course. There probably was one But I don't remember learning a lot about, you know, Sykes-Picot and how the place got trued up, unless you really specialized in that particular area.
Professor Blum didn't teach that?
I taught American history.
Oh, okay.
We're American history. We heard the names, et cetera, but I don't think we really understood. I didn't understand it even as a senator until later on in my process as I really began to visit, spend time, listen, and see the impact on Iraq policy, on Afghanistan policy. You know, witness a lawyer juror, go to a shura and sit down and have 100 Afghan faces staring at me with 50 years experience of fighting for their country, talking to me about, you know, what we were trying to do. And you recognize that if you can't connect to those things and understand them, you're going to fail. And we didn't understand those things. I am told, I mean, I'm not going to go backwards too far, but I'll tell you, there are people who did not know the distinction between Sunni and Shia when we made a decision to go into Iraq. Mm-hmm. And what we did was turn something absolutely topsy-turvy, upside down, reversing 1,200 years, basically, of a history. And so you've got to understand these things. And the tribalism, I find, is far more pronounced today. And if you stop and think about it, by the way, we have a lot of it here in America.
Yep.
I mean, a lot. You know, Boston and New York and, you know, look at how the boroughs are divided up and who lives where and what happens and who celebrates what. And, you know, we're not free of it. So people need to understand it better in the context of how you get things done and patch people together in order to have the unity that we often talk about in fairly simplified terms. And it never is quite as simple as the nice principle lays out.
You know, I'm getting a lot of signals, and you have to go to Ottawa, but I think they've given me permission. Let me let Jane, who has the microphone, and Richard, who had the microphone, both make a quick question and then let him answer. That's sort of my way of putting two questions
Jane,
in one.
Jane,
is that okay?
Jane Harmon.
Yeah.
Well, I'm proud to serve on your foreign policy board, and I know everyone here is astounded at your energy and your focus and your unrelenting idealism. I just wanted to ask a question about one of the good unintended consequences of the Iran deal, which I personally supported. And that is that the Gulf states, which are worried about Iran, have aligned more closely with Israel. And there are informal conversations, the Israelis admit this, between Israel and many of the Gulf states. Could that provide an opening to restart the peace
deal? And before you start, Richard has the mic. I've gone where the mics are. We can combine questions, perhaps.
Richard has, no less.
I know. Okay. Slumming at another institute.
Well, thank you. Mr. Secretary, arguably the biggest or one of the biggest intellectual ideas animating this administration's foreign policy was the so-called pivot or rebalance to Asia. And a principal part of that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so much so that your colleague, the Secretary of Defense, essentially said he'd trade a carrier task force if he could get this agreement. Given Brexit, given the fact that TPP has been stalled in the Senate, what is your sense about what can be done over the next 6 months while you all are still in power to get this? And if you can't, what is it, not that you can do to offset the economic stakes you discussed a few minutes ago with Walter, but the strategic stakes? Because not going through this, with this, as you know better than anyone in this room, would raise major questions about American reliability amongst our colleagues and our allies in Asia. What would we do to essentially reassure them?
And I really want to apologize. I know there were a lot of other hands, and we tried hard. But so the Gulf states and then trade and TPP.
Yeah. Let me also emphasize to everybody here, the Gulf states had questions about the deal, no question about it, but they ultimately supported it, and they do support it, and has brought us closer together with them too, because we've spent a lot of time sitting down with them, working through their needs, and we have a much clearer sense, and we are working with them now much more closely in training, in providing certain equipment, sharing intelligence, and in working on a mutual defense concept for the region, which includes missile defense. So they will be safer, we believe, in the long run. And I'm not going to go into all the details of it, but I really think the conversations we've had with Iran and with them, I think it is possible over a period of time here for a better understanding to be reached about the direction. And if we're more successful faster in getting Daesh under control, dealing with Assad and getting some stability, I think things will begin to evolve and move. Saudi Arabia, by the way, the Deputy Crown Prince has announced with King Salman and the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, a very ambitious program for the country in terms of their diversifying their economy. And they're really reaching. They've seen what the United Arab Emirates have done. They've seen what Israel has done. Israel, by the way, has enormous, and I talked to Bibi about this, enormous ability to play a huge financial and mentorship and advisory role in the region, which they now seem to be more open to. And on agriculture, for instance, Egypt has about a $16 billion agriculture deficit. They've got a huge energy deficit. They desperately need help to transition. Israel could become a financial powerhouse, more than it is, in a sense, regionally, and a mentor in each of these sectors that could be transformational for those countries too, which is one of the reasons why I never do give up on this idea of trying to move the process forward, because strategically it's so key to everybody there. The difficulty is not envisioning what the final status agreement might look like. The difficulty really is getting people to make the decisions to move towards it. I think most people understand the basic framework. So we're trying to do that. We're going to keep doing it. I'm hopeful. I'm not hopeful. I know that with the right choices by Israel itself, the Arab world is poised to do very different things. There's no question in my mind. And this is an opportunity in that regard. With respect, Richard, to Iran and
the pivot TPP.
The TPP and the whole rebalance to Asia. I'd be less than candid to you. I mean, I want to be honest about the stakes here. The TPP is a central ingredient of America's presence in the region economically going forward. The fastest growing region in the world, one of the most exciting. We were just in Vietnam, the president and I, with our teams, and it was very, very exciting. There's a raging capitalism there. They still have some state-owned enterprises, but they're beginning to transition those. I think they will privatize over a period of time. There's immense thirst for technology, for change, for a bigger, you know, role. And so if we were to take the hard work of these last 7 years and suddenly lose it over this parochialism and this felt need locally, we would be shooting ourselves in the foot gigantically, strategically and economically. And so I think what hasn't happened yet, we have not fully engaged with the Congress. It's a very difficult time to do that, given the race and what's happening. And so once we get fully engaged, I think we have very powerful arguments to make, and we'll be looking to people like you and others, businesses, the Chamber of Commerce, think tanks, loads of people will brief. And there are some things we can brief on in a classified session that I can't talk about here that I believe would have a profound impact on the thinking of lots of senators and congressmen. So I think this is just a hugely important step for the United States and vital to our global leadership and vital to our economic future. And I hope we don't blow it.
Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for your service to the nation. Thank you. Safe travels. Safe travels.